This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast. Hello and welcome to Reality Check. Today is Tuesday, the 18th of August, 2009, and I'm your host, Tony Pittman. And this is actually episode 3 of Reality Check here on Joy 94.9. Reality Check is a show designed to give you a healthy dose of reality. And we do that by promoting the art of critical thinking and skeptical analysis. Each week we bring you a roundup of LGBT news, followed by an in-depth analysis of an issue related to the paranormal or the pseudoscientific. And finally, we wrap up each show with a movie review. Tonight, after our LGBT news roundup, we're going to begin an in-depth analysis of the science, or lack of it, behind the so-called blood type diet. Then, in our movie review section, I'll review three films, including Reality Check's first five-star must-see movie recommendation. So stay tuned here until 2 o'clock to find out what it is. But right now, let's get straight into our first segment, the LGBT News Roundup for this week. Okay, here's your LGBT news for the last 7 days or so. Our first news item comes from the Indian subcontinent and one of the five biggest cities in the world, Mumbai. And that is the Mumbai Gay Pride March, actually called the Queer Azadi March, Azadi meaning freedom. The march took place on Sunday, August 16th, a day after the 62nd anniversary of India's independence, and about 3,000 people apparently took part. This was the first gay pride march in India since the 2nd of July, which was the day on which the New Delhi High Court repealed Section 377 of India's Penal Code, the sodomy law that was used to criminalise homosexual activity. So there was indeed a lot to celebrate in Mumbai this past weekend. New Delhi, Bangalore and Chennai all held their pride marches this year back on June 28th, the day of the 40th anniversary of the Stonewall riots, and actually, as it turned out, just 4 days before the sodomy law decision came down. Gay pride marches are actually a very new phenomenon in India. The first ever pride marches in Delhi, Bangalore and Mumbai only took place last year. Calcutta has had variations of gay pride marches since 1999 that have gradually been growing over the years, but it was really only last year that formal gay pride marches began springing up all over the country. And I should also mention that the decision of the New Delhi High Court to repeal India's sodomy law is currently being challenged and has gone to the Indian Supreme Court. So let's just hope that that decision will be upheld and India's hated sodomy law will finally be abolished. If the Supreme Court does uphold that decision, it will be a major victory in the history of LGBT rights in the world. In terms of sheer numbers of people affected by the decision, it will be one of the most important LGBT advances ever. Remember, over 17% of the world's population lives in India. So with the stroke of a pen, over 17% of the world's LGBT people will finally escape the threat of prosecution. It will be huge news. And don't worry, listener, we will definitely report on it here on Reality Check. Now, from India to North America, where on Saturday, August 15th, the Great National Kiss-In was held in 50 cities across the United States and Canada. The purpose of the event was to show that, and I quote, "any person, anywhere, should be able to kiss whomever they want, whenever they want," end quote. And it was also designed partly as a protest against the homophobia of the Mormon Church, otherwise known as the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The impetus for the nationwide event was the arrest of a same-sex couple in July for trespass in front of the giant Mormon temple in Salt Lake City, Utah, after they were allegedly seen kissing. The arrest of the two young men caused particular frustration amongst a lot of LGBT people because the Mormon Church had been one of the largest and most visible supporters of the Yes on Proposition 8 campaign in California last year. That is the ballot campaign that was ultimately successful in amending the California Constitution and removing the right to same-sex marriage in that state. Kiss-ins involving both same-sex and opposite-sex couples were held across the United States and Canada, including in Salt Lake City and Atlanta and Washington, D.C. Now, moving to Iraq and much less pleasant news to report, Human Rights Watch launched a report in Beirut, Lebanon yesterday entitled, "They Want Us Exterminated, Murder, Torture, Sexual Orientation, and Gender in Iraq." In the report, Human Rights Watch claims that Iraqi militias are increasingly torturing and executing men suspected of homosexuality, but the authorities in Baghdad are doing nothing to stop the violence. The New York-based group said that hundreds of men have been kidnapped, tortured, and killed this year in a wave of violence that began in the Baghdad Sadr city stronghold of Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr's Mahdi Army Militia. The report stated it is almost impossible to calculate how many men were killed, but estimated the figure in the hundreds. Mahdi Army spokesmen have suggested that military action was the remedy for the feminization of Iraqi men, according to the report, in which survivors are quoted as saying that militiamen invade their homes and interrogate victims in order to get the names of other potential victims before finally killing them. Human Rights Watch said that Iraqi doctors and morgue employees also have records of grotesque torture marks on the bodies of men, including mutilation and even anuses glued shut. Motives for the murder include fears that Iraqis' men's masculinity is under threat, Human Rights Watch reported. It also said that some of the murders were so-called honor killings carried out by victims' family members because unmanly behavior threatened the reputation of the family or tribe. So this is not really new news. We've been hearing these reports fairly regularly over the last few months, but hopefully the launch of this detailed and carefully investigated report by Human Rights Watch will stimulate some action on the ground in Iraq to deal with the situation, because at the moment the situation for LGBT people in Iraq looks very, very grim indeed. And our final news story today comes from closer to home, and it's from Canberra, yes, our nation's mighty capital. Now, I don't know if you were able to make it, dear listener, but on Thursday, August 13th, the National Marriage Breakfast took place in the Great Hall of Parliament House. to stand up for the protection of the institution of marriage and to mark the 5th anniversary of the passing of the Marriage Amendment Act, the act that explicitly banned same-sex marriage by defining marriage as a union between a man and a woman. This lovely breakfast was organised by groups such as the Australian Christian Lobby and the Australian Family Association. There were a number of speakers and the audience reportedly cheered very loudly each time a speaker declared his or her support for marriage as the union of a man and a woman. Yes, dear listener, these are those fundamentalist Christians like Fred Nile and Jim Wallace who oppose LGBT equality at every possible opportunity. And these people are experts in sophistry and Orwellian doublespeak. For example, they claim to be the voice of tolerance. Yes, can you believe it? These people who hysterically oppose every advance in LGBT rights actually claim to be the voice of tolerance. They also claim that if same-sex marriage is allowed, that will mean imposing what they call the homosexual lifestyle on them, as if this is all about them. We are the ones who are denied rights because they are using the state to deny our rights based on their religious view of morality, and they claim that we, by having the same right to marry as everyone else, will be imposing our lifestyles on them. I mean, they really are a charming crowd, and it's bizarre how their minds work. But really, the very best example of Orwellian doublespeak that appeared on Thursday was the title of the Labour Party senator who gave an address. That senator, who endorsed the cheerful celebration of exclusion of same-sex couples from marriage, was in fact Senator Ursula Stevens, the Parliamentary Secretary for Social Inclusion. So there you have it, listener. A lesson in doublespeak. You are tolerant by being intolerant. You are imposed upon by imposing on others. And you support social inclusion by celebrating exclusion. It's just amazing. If you put a cat in front of these people, I'm sure they'd be capable of telling you it was a dog. And if you held up a pure white sheet of paper in front of them, I'm sure they could convince themselves it was black. I think maybe they need to listen to a bit of reality check and learn a little bit more about critical thinking. Anyway, by far the coolest thing that happened at the Great National Marriage Breakfast was that two LGBT rights activists, John Kloprog and John Davey, got in and then stood on the stage during the address by Senator Stevens with a placard simply saying, "Inclusion equals equality," because it seemed that the senator hadn't quite realised that. So they stood there on the stage for a few minutes before being forcibly removed, apparently by members of the audience. So I say, good on you, John Kloprog and John Davey, for being the only voices of sanity and reason at that vile event. You two are the official reality check heroes of the week. We send lots of admiration your way. All right, that's enough news for today. Let's listen to a song now, and when we come back, we're going to get into some serious skeptical analysis. Today, we'll delve deeper into what really lies behind the blood type diet. So stay tuned for that after this song here on Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to Reality Check here on Joy 94.9. I'm Tony Pittman and the time is 1:22. And the song you just heard there was I Would Die For You by none other than Prince. A classic there from the year 1984. Right, now we move into the part of the show where we get into some analysis of the paranormal and pseudoscientific. Now, first, actually, just quickly, before we get into the blood type diet, I just want to briefly mention psychic powers once again. We talked about psychic powers in the first show, and then in the last episode, we talked a bit about psychic detectives. And I've had a little bit of feedback from some listeners. Now, I don't want to get into it too much again this episode, and I'm sure that this is not the last you'll hear about psychics here on Reality Check, but I did want to make one quick comment, and that is this, that it is absolutely true that skeptics cannot prove that psychic powers don't exist. For every case that a skeptic investigates and shows that in that specific case, there is no reason to believe that psychic powers were used, there will always be someone who says, ah, well, maybe not in that case, but what about this case, huh, Mr. Skeptic, huh? What about this one? This one is real psychic powers. And of course, if the skeptic investigates that new case and finds there's nothing to it, another one will always spring up, and then another, and then another, and it will never end. But in the end, the onus is not on the skeptic to prove that psychic powers don't exist, because that's impossible to prove. The onus is on those claiming psychic powers to prove that they do exist. At least if they want to be believed by the scientific and skeptical community. And remember, if you're unsure of what to believe, and the psychic seems to present his or her case in a pretty convincing way, as they almost always do, just remember this. The claim to have psychic powers is an absolutely extraordinary claim. If psychic powers are proven to exist, that will be a revolution in science on a par with the Copernican or the Darwinian revolutions. That will fundamentally change how not only our understanding of the human body and the five senses and the human brain and neurology and psychology and so much else, it will also fundamentally alter our understanding of basic physics and how information is transmitted across distances. Because until now, no mechanism has been proposed by psychics as to how they could possibly know what is inside a sealed distant box, for example. And no mechanism is known to scientists as to how this information could be somehow transmitted to a human brain. I mean, is it in the form of some kind of electromagnetic radiation? And then which one? Is it radio waves? Is it microwaves? Where's the transmitter? Where is the receiver in the brain? And if it's not this method, then how? How is that information communicated? So if psychic powers were conclusively shown to exist, that would fundamentally alter our understanding of the most basic sciences. And for that reason, it could even be the biggest revolution in scientific thought ever. So before you and say, well, yeah, I'm not sure, yeah, I guess I believe in psychic powers from what I've heard, just think about the implications of what you're saying. Because what you're really saying is, well, I don't think that the explanations that are based on science and reason and evidence are true. And actually, I prefer an explanation that defies all scientific knowledge and that involves possibly the most fundamental revolution in human understanding ever. Now, that may be true, but in my opinion, you would need pretty convincing and watertight evidence to make that call. Anyway, that's the last word on psychics for today at least. Now let's move on to the main topic of pseudoscience for this week, and that is the so-called blood type diet, as expounded by Dr. Peter D'Adamo in his best-selling book, Eat Right for Your Type. In our last episode, I actually gave you a summary of the theories behind the blood type diet as expounded in Dr. D'Adamo's book, so I won't go over them again in detail today. If you want to hear that summary, You can download episode 2 of Reality Check as a podcast at joy.org.au and click there on podcasts. What I want to do today is to get into a bit of analysis of the theories that Dr. D'Adamo puts forward in his book and see if they stand up to scientific examination or not. First, just as a preliminary point, I'd like to note that the title doctor that Dr. D'Adamo uses doesn't actually mean that he's a medical doctor, nor does it mean that he has a PhD. He calls himself a doctor of naturopathy and says on his website that he studied naturopathy in Seattle, Washington. So that might be the first clue that what we're dealing with here may not be entirely grounded in science and careful research. Naturopaths are not generally known for their adherence to science and critical thinking. Now, of course, I don't want to make the logical fallacy here of argument from authority, or in this case, argument from lack of authority. In other words, I don't want to say that just because he's a naturopath, his theories won't be scientifically sound. That would be a very uncritical assumption to make. His theories may well be sound. What we must do as skeptics is examine those theories and claims as objectively as possible and independently of who's making them. And a second preliminary point that I wanted to mention is that I received a comment from one listener from last week that Dr. D'Adamo's theories that I went through last episode are not immediately obviously pseudoscientific. In fact, at first glance, they seem quite plausible. And that's absolutely true. With the blood type diet, we're not dealing with a claim that is obviously outlandish and absurd, as many claims of supposed inventions or discoveries are. And I confess that last episode I was adopting a certain disparaging tone at times when I was describing Dr. D'Adamo's theories, when there was actually nothing that was obviously wrong with them or stupid about them. So I may have been getting a little bit ahead of myself there because I know what's coming. And frankly, to be as diplomatic as possible, I have little respect for Dr. D'Adamo and how he markets his books and puts himself out there as an authority. But I don't want to jump to the end already, and I don't want to poison the well before we start, so let's just get into it. A detailed examination of Dr. D'Adamo's theories. Dr. D'Adamo claims that our ideal diet depends on our ABO blood type. And he constructs his theory through a series of building blocks. The first of these building blocks involves looking at the evolution of human ABO blood types and how they related to changes in human diet, and concluding from that that people should eat foods corresponding with what their blood type ancestors used to eat. Now, before launching into an examination of the real history of human blood types and whether Dr. D'Adamo actually gets that right or not, I just wanted to step back for a moment and analyze Dr. D'Adamo's argument based purely on what he says, without looking at what any scientists may have said about it. So if you think about what the doctor is saying for a little while, it quite soon becomes pretty clear that there's a problem with the point he makes about evolution of human blood types and the diets that we should follow today. So let's imagine that everything that Dr. D'Adamo says about human blood type evolution is true. And let's just look at the simple claim that type O's ate lots of meat, they were the first humans, and then 20,000 years ago, type A's appeared and they became agrarian and they started eating lots of grains. Even if that were true, it would be ridiculous to suggest that that should be the guide to what we should eat today. Because Dr. D'Adamo hasn't shown that the reason the blood type changed was because the diet changed. that these two things, blood type and diet, are linked. Even if blood type A did arise at about the same time that humans started growing crops, that doesn't mean that that change in blood type was related to diet. It could have been related to any one of a myriad of other factors. Humans started to eat grains, and at roughly the same time, a mutation in the gene for a particular protein on the surface of the red blood cell occurred that brought about blood type A, and that mutation stuck around in the population. Well, so what? It doesn't mean it was related to diet. Maybe it was a completely neutral mutation and gave no evolutionary advantage, but also no disadvantage, so it just stayed around. Maybe it did give a slight evolutionary advantage to those with type A, but this was related to immunity to smallpox or plague or some other disease and wasn't connected to diet. So just because the two things happened at around the same time, the appearance of type A and the beginnings of cultivating grains, wouldn't mean that they are necessarily interconnected or that one is the cause of the other. And after all, let's remember what we're talking about here. Blood type is determined by a protein on the surface of red blood cells. And the function of red blood cells is to transfer oxygen from the lungs to the body's tissues and then bring carbon dioxide back to the lungs. So red blood cells don't play an important role in digestion. And also, Dr. Didamo doesn't say that type O's and type A's then lived separately, and that the O's kept eating only meat, and the type A's kept eating only grains, and then the O's that ate grains got sick and weak and couldn't reproduce as well, and then the same happened to the type A's that ate lots of meat. Because if blood type actually were so important to diet, that is what would have had to have happened for there to be an evolutionary changes here. So, in fact, Dr. Didamo doesn't go into much detail at all about what happened between the arrival of blood A on the scene and then today. He kind of just jumps. He makes very broad claims about what our ancestors supposedly ate and then jumps ahead to today and says what we should eat. And let's also consider for a moment the implications of what he's saying. Now, I think most people are familiar with the basic genetics of blood type, that we all carry two alleles for blood type, and that the A and B are dominant, and the O allele is recessive. So that means if you are AO, that is with the A allele on one chromosome and the O allele on the other chromosome, you will be type A. Also, if you are AA. But if you have the O allele on both chromosomes, you'll be type O. Right? That's just classic high school dominant recessive inheritance. So let's look at a hypothetical family. Well, hypothetical because I'm using it as an example here, but there must be millions of real families like this in the world. So in this family, the mother is blood type A and is genetically AO. The father is blood type B and genetically BO. They have two children. One is blood type AB and one is type O. That is a perfectly plausible situation. So within the same family unit, you have all four blood types. So what Dr. Didamo is saying is that each member of this family should be eating very, very different diets. And then remember that what happened in this family can happen in the next generation and the next and the next. So you go back hundreds of generations and find a series of ever-changing A's and B's and O's and AB's every step. So if your blood type really were that important to your health, as Dr. Didamo says, this wouldn't happen. Evolution just doesn't work like that. Yet, Dr. Didamo says, and I quote, "Your blood type is a more reliable measure of your identity than race, culture, or geography." A very bold claim. So what Dr. Dedamo is really saying is that I have more in common with some ancient ancestor than with my immediate family. Let me finally quote Dr. Edward Blondes from his review of the Dr. Dedamo's book, which is available online. Dr. Blondes says, and I quote, "There is no question that over the millennia there has been an infinite variety of genetic mixing. It makes it all a bit of a stretch to say, for example, that a type O today has the same genetic imperatives as a type O roaming the savannah with spear in hand." A bit of a stretch indeed. All right, let's listen to another song now, and when we come back, we'll take a look at whether the description that Dr. Dedamo gives of the evolution of human blood types actually stands up to analysis.
This is a podcast from Joy 94.9, a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station. For more content, please go to our website at joy.org.au, or if you're in Melbourne, tune in to Joy 94.9.
Hi, I'm Cindy Lauper, and if you just want to have fun, do you? Keep listening to Joy 94.9 FM.
Yes, do that. Do keep listening to Joy 94.9. The show you're listening to is Reality Check, and I'm your host, Tony Pittman. And the song you just heard there was Cry For You by September. Now, let's get back into looking at Dr. Dedamo's blood type diet theory. I have to say, when I read the doctor's description of the history of human blood types, it seemed perfectly reasonable to me, as I suspect it would to most people. The evolution of human blood types is not something that is generally well known. In fact, when I went to investigate it myself, I had trouble finding anything at all written about it. It seems, in fact, that it is something that only a few scientists in the world who are investigating this field really have much knowledge about. So let's see what Dr. Dedamo says about it and compare that with what those scientists say. So just a quick refresher from last week. In a nutshell, Dr. Dedamo says that all humans began as type O's. Then the type A's appeared about 20,000 years ago. Then the type B arose about 12 or 13,000 years ago. And finally, the type AB's first arose about 1,000 years ago. Hang on. What was that last one? Type AB's only began to appear 1,000 years ago? Well, that is exactly what Dr. Dedamo says. He says, and I quote, "Until 10 or 12 centuries ago, there was no type AB blood." Once again, a rather bold claim there from the doctor. And this was, in fact, the first clue for me that maybe Dr. Dedamo's facts here were not quite as accurate as they may have first appeared. 1,000 years ago, that would be about the year 1000 AD. That's the middle of the Middle Ages. That's about the time of the Norman conquest of England in 1066. In evolutionary terms, that is extremely recent. So I did some investigation and I contacted some experts around the world who are working in the field of paleontology, anthropology, genetics, and human evolution. And I'm afraid to say that what they told me doesn't look too good for the first building block of Dr. Dedamo's theory. The first indication that all is not well in Dr. Dedamo's theory is that other primates also have ABO blood types. For example, chimpanzees are mostly type A with some type O's. This would appear to indicate that at least one of the ABO blood types actually arose not 10 or 20,000 years ago, but millions of years ago, before humans and chimpanzees branched off the evolutionary tree to go their separate ways. The two most important scientific studies published on this topic in recent years support that theory. They are a paper published by Saito and Yamamoto in 1997 and one published just last year by a scientist called Francesc Calafell and five other researchers from the Institute of Evolutionary Biology at the Pompeu Fabra University in Barcelona and published in the journal Human Genetics. In that most recent paper, the scientists studied hundreds of DNA sequences from around the world and concluded that the ancestral human blood type was type A. This blood type was shared with chimpanzees and bonobos. The gene for blood type B then arose 3.5 million years ago after humans had split from the other primates. And the gene for the O allele actually arose through mutation three different times independently during human evolution. And those type O's appeared at about 2.5 and 1.15 million years ago, and also at about 316,000 years ago. So, it would seem that the first building block of Dr. Dodamo's blood type diet has been completely blown out of the water. Humans didn't begin as type O's. They began as type A's. Type B's didn't arise about 12,000 years ago, but about 3.5 million years ago. And type AB's didn't just appear 1,000 years ago in the Middle Ages. But once type B's arose and were living with type A's, there would have to have been type B's at the same time. So that is 3.5 million years ago, not 1,000 years ago. So, well, and then, in fact, the type O's were, in fact, the last to appear, and they appeared independently three times over the last 2.5 million years. So, Dr. Dodamo, I hate to say it, but you are wrong in the extreme. Wrong in the order in which the human blood types appeared, and orders of magnitude wrong in the times at which they appeared. And the fact that Dr. Dodamo is so wrong in the order and times of appearance of human ABO blood types throws a big spanner into how his theory basically works, because his whole diet is based on the idea that because type O's were hunter-gatherers and ate lots of meat and animal protein thousands of years ago, that's the ideal type diet for type O's today. And then because type A's were the docile agrarians and ate lots of cereals thousands of years ago, then type A's today should do the same. But just as we've seen just now, that's not true. Type O's didn't eat any more meat than the other blood types. And type A's didn't eat any more grains than the other blood types. All four blood types had arisen hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years, before humans started to change their diet through growing crops and domesticating animals about 12,000 years ago. So that means all four blood types have always eaten the same diet, whether that be mostly meat or mostly grains or whatever. So it's not looking too good for Dr. Dodamo's blood type diet so far. But that doesn't mean the whole thing is all bunk. It may still be true that blood type determines what you should eat for optimum health and well-being. Can Dr. Dodamo's theory be saved? Will he snatch victory from the jaws of defeat? Well, to find out, dear listener, I'm afraid that you're going to have to come back at the same time next week. Originally, I thought I would be able to deal with Dr. Dodamo's blood type diet in one episode, but it looks as if we're going to need several episodes to get through it. It's just that there is so much wrong with what he says but not wrong in a way that's immediately apparent. So that takes time to deal with properly. Well, at least I hope we're all learning something along the way. Now, just quickly, before I finish today's section on the blood type diet, I would like to thank those experts who I contacted and who helped me with information on the evolution of human blood types. And so in Australia, that's big thanks to Professor Simon Eastiel, Professor Masij Henneberg, and Dr. Varsha Pilbrow. And in the United States, big thanks to Dr. John Relathford, Dr. John Hawkes, Professor Jim Mielke, and Professor Luca Cavalli-Sforza. Thank you very much to all of those people. And if you do have any questions about the blood type diet or anything else that we've covered on the show, or maybe something you'd like us to cover on the show, please feel free to send us an email. The address is realitychecktony@gmail.com. That's realitychecktony, T-O-N-Y, @gmail.com. All right, let's listen to one more song, and we don't have much time, but I'll do quick movie reviews when we come back after this.
Joy. 94.9.
Hello, we're the Kransky sisters on Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to Reality Check with me, Tony Pittman, on Joy 94.9. Also streaming live at joy.org.au and available as a podcast to listen to anywhere in the world on your little pod. The time now is 1 minute past two, and the song you just heard there was Fortress Around Your Heart, an old one by Sting from, 1985. Now, we are rapidly running out of time, but I did promise you a quick movie review and three movies, so I will quickly do a movie review of three films in about 3 minutes. So, the three films I've seen in the last week, the first one was a local film actually made in Victoria, in the town of Ararat in Western Victoria, and that is Lake Mungo. And this is an interesting little film. It's a horror ghost story filmed as a mockumentary, in that it's done completely in a documentary style, but it's fiction, so they're all actors. And also with an element of, what would I call it, found footage, the Blair Witch Project style, where within the mockumentary, the characters find footage, find photos, and find video material that reveals information that develops the story further. It's a good little film. It's very spooky. It's basically a ghost story. There's lots of twists and revelations. The narrative develops in an interesting way. There's some creepy parts, and there is a great revelation, a great kind of original idea is thrown into this ghost story mix with the footage that is discovered that the girl who died actually filmed 4 months on her 4 months before her death on her mobile phone camera. I won't reveal too much, but that's a very scary scene, and I didn't see that coming at all. It's quite an original idea. And it's interesting that the film it's not a dramatic film in any way. It's kind of a quiet, slow burn chills. But apparently the rights to make the remake have been bought up by a Hollywood studio, and they're planning to do a remake of this movie. And I think it has a lot of potential. So if they do it well, if they get a good script writer and good director, it could work out to be a really well done and very scary movie. So let's hope that they actually do a good job of the remake of Lake Mungo. Now, very briefly, the second film I saw was Balibo, which is the story of the 5 Australian journalists who were murdered by the Indonesian armed forces in East Timor in 1975 when they went there to cover the invasion of East Timor by Indonesia. And this movie basically follows the activities of the five journalists in East Timor in the days leading up to their death, and then the investigation of their disappearance by another Australian journalist, Roger East, 3 weeks later, who basically follows their paths. And the story moves between the five journalists and the story of Roger East, back and forth between them. It's sometimes a little bit confusing to work out where we are and what time we're in and who was there, and because the stories are overlaid. And that was a bit distracting at times. But overall, I think this is a film well worth visiting. It's a very important story to know. It's interesting history of Australia and East Timor and the Indonesian invasion. And it's a well-done movie, particularly disturbing the scene when the five journalists actually get murdered towards the end of the movie. So not a pleasant subject, but a pretty well done film, I think. And finally, I promised I would tell you the 5-star must see movie recommendation, and that is a documentary that I saw on the last day of the Melbourne International Film Festival, which is called Outrage. And this is a documentary from the United States, basically about all the, and I think they're almost all Republican politicians in the United States who are, let's say, same-sex attracted but are living in the closet. And the documentary names names. It talks about them openly and talks about their sexual experiences. And these are all members of Congress or former members of Congress or other high-level politicians who having men who have had relationships with other men and are living in the closet. And it is absolutely gripping viewing. It's a fantastic documentary. I thoroughly recommend it. It's funny, it's shocking, and it's very important that this story be told, because as they point out, these same-sex attracted men living in the closet consistently voted against almost every piece of legislation which would have advanced LGBT rights that came before them. And it's just the pure hypocrisy that shines through in the legislative careers of these congressmen. So I think it's a very, very important subject, and this documentary handles it and exposes this in a very, very entertaining, compelling way. I think it's an absolutely fabulous documentary, and everyone who can, gay, straight, whatever, bi, everyone, it's relevant for everyone, should really get out there and see it. Having said that, though, it's not on general release in Australia yet. I saw it at the film festival. I really hope it will get picked up by a distributor here. I will investigate that and I'll get back to you and let you know. So when it does get out on general release, I'll let you know, and it's a highly worthy, highly, highly recommended film to see. And that brings us to the end of the third episode of Reality Check here on Joy 94.9. I hope you enjoyed the show. Please send any questions, comments, or feedback to realitychecktony@gmail.com. And remember to tune in at 1 o'clock next Tuesday for episode 4. Have a great week, everyone. See you next week.
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.